How's everybody doing? Good, good, good. Well, we're on lesson 25, and I did not get lesson 24 loaded last week. That was my fault. So I'll get both of them loaded tomorrow or tonight. It's tonight's lesson and last week's lesson. And so we're halfway on we're on the home stretch, I guess you might want to say. We're more than halfway. This lesson will put us more than halfway through the class. And so last week, what did we talk about? Those of you who were here last week, what did we go over? Anybody remember?
Ten Commandments.
And what do we know about the Ten Commandments? What was the purpose for it? What was the reason? Why did God give them Ten Commandments? Or what does the Ten Commandments reveal to us? Nothing?
No.
Do we have to live by the Ten Commandments today?
No.
Or can we throw the Ten Commandments out the door?
To a certain degree, you still have to follow.
You still have to follow? Okay.
Laws.
Huh? The laws? Yeah, we there too. And is there any purpose to the Ten Commandments?
We'll never measure up to God's standard.
Yeah, it gives us this picture that we can never achieve to. We talked quite a bit about, we spent a lot of time going through each one and looking at each one and saying, okay, how does that apply today? And we talked a lot about the law that God had given. And we talked a little bit about how the children of Israel quickly agreed to the law before they even had it. Scott reminded me of that this week. He came to me and said, hey, I want you to know, you agreed to stuff up there on Sunday morning when you got licensed before you even knew everything was coming. You know, all the stuff.
Right.
He was telling me, he says, it reminded me of the class. And I'm like, oh, that's true. I just said I do. But I don't know everything that's going to happen. The children of Israel did that, didn't they? They just kind of agreed and said, hey, we will do whatever you say, Lord. And then he brings these Ten Commandments. So let's see what happens tonight, then. We're going to go through that.
Just a thought, we weren't here last week. So
yeah.
I don't know, I'm way out there. But in Sunday school class, we've been watching Robbie.
Uh-huh.
And does the Ten Commandments give us that good, establish that good that we're talking about in Sunday school? You know, we're talking about good and having a standard, and that's what good is based on, because if every man made up his own mind what good is,
the moral law theory,
right,
or the moral law argument.
And doesn't the Ten Commandments give us that standard?
Well, what do you think?
I don't know, I'm asking.
Jesus, when he became the deliverer, he took the Ten Commandments and went, oh,
right.
So,
right.
He went to a whole new level.
Yeah.
So, as he took them, but what Lori's asking is,
doesn't he give us a basis?
Yes. So let's take a step back. Let me flip that question around. Let's say the Ten Commandments, we never had it. We never had the Ten Commandments growing up as a kid. It was never taught in school. Would you and I still recognize right and wrong without the Ten Commandments?
I think to a degree you would.
Okay. So, and why
right.
would you say that? Why would you say that?
Who would set that that's wrong? If you didn't have something before, like, do you know
wrong? Yeah. Brent, I agree with you. Because God has written man's law on their heart. Automatic. So, even a child, if you think about a child at 3-4 years old, they don't know the Ten Commandments at all. You don't have to teach them to do wrong. We know we've established that, right? You can see that in your kids. You put a toy out there on the floor and they'll fight over it. And you don't have to teach them that. You have to teach them to be good on that. Yet when you ask them, if they go steal a cookie from the cookie jar or something, and you ask them, who got into the cookies? Anna will do this at home if she gets into something. If she has something in her hand, she'll put it behind her back. She will look down and won't look in the eye, or she'll run off. I didn't teach her that. And yet she knows somewhere along the line she's wrong. She did wrong. Now, it could be the tone of voice that I say something to her. It could be something other than that, or she's picked up that. But she knows that she's done something wrong. And so every human being is born with that. Adam and Eve, when they sinned in the garden, and they ate of the fruit, nobody told them they did wrong, did they? They were immediately...
Well, they were told that they would be doing right by the devil.
Correct. But they immediately went and hid themselves because they knew they had done wrong. Their eyes were opened. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, because when sin entered the world, mankind... Now, God established the law for a moral basis. It also is a purpose so that it points us to Him. Without the law, we don't know that we have no sin. Paul says that. So, and I think that's where you're going from. Without the law, we would not know right and wrong. Mm-hmm. So there is an element that we have to have a law there to let us know that we can't achieve perfection and we can't reestablish that bridge that was broken in our picture.
Like you said, if you break one, you break them all.
Right. You're guilty of, if you're guilty of one, you're guilty of all of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so does that answer the question? Or maybe
a thought. Rather
the thought.
Question.
Not the thought of it, yeah. It's not really a question, yeah. Yeah, when you're thinking about, when we think about that, and in this lesson, we're going to flip it and we're going to go into where God tells them to build this tabernacle. Anybody know what a tabernacle is?
Is it like a place where God comes down?
Yeah. So we're going to cover that here. And so tonight our lesson is in Exodus 24 and 25. So we can turn there. And we're going to go forward from there. And so while we're turning to Exodus 24, and we're in lesson 25, we're going to see what happens. We had Moses, he gets the Ten Commandments, and God writes them on paper for us so they could stay on forever, right? That's how he did it. What did he write them on? He wrote them on stone. Why would you think God would choose to write them on stone?
Permanent,
right? You can go to pretty much anywhere in the world and find markings on stone, fossils. You know, you can go up into the mountains and find fossils that were, you know, how they get there. They're fish, and they're way up in the mountains and things like that. It's a long lasting thing, and he wanted it permanent, and he wanted it written down and a record of what his standard was, and to make it so that future generations would have that. So Exodus 24:12 says this. 24 verse 12 says this, "Then the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and stay there, and I will give you the tablets of stone which I have inscribed, the instructions and commands, so you can teach the people." That's what God said there. And so Moses went up there and he stayed there for 40 days and 40 nights. And during that time, while he was there, Moses was accompanied with his servant Joshua, his right-hand man, not really his servant, his right-hand man. Joshua would eventually take over his position as leader of the children of Israel. And here he had him with him on this mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. 24:16-18. Someone want to read that?
"And the glory of Jehovah abode upon the Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day he called unto Moses out of the midst of the cloud. And the appearance of the glory of Jehovah was like devouring fire on top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. And Moses entered into the midst of the cloud and went up into the mount. And Moses was in the mount for 40 days and 40 nights."
Wow. So he disappeared up in there, and he's there for 40 days and 40 nights on the mountain. Where else do we have the record of 40 days?
Noah.
Noah. Yeah, and you will see that over and over again. The 40 days, there's that that number, 40 days, 40 days in the mountain, 40 days in the wilderness, 40 years they wandered around. That 40 constantly keeps coming at. There's certain things in the Bible where a pattern of numbers stay consistent. You use a certain number. Number 7 shows up a lot.
3.
Yeah, number 8 is in the Bible means a new beginning, new something new. So that it constantly keeps showing up over and over again. You'll see that as we go through there. So the Lord, he now begins to instruct the children of Israel, and we're going to jump over to chapter 25, 1 through 8. And here is where God is going to instruct Moses on how to build this tabernacle. So we are going to come right here, right now. So we've got, come all the way down through, we're 1,500 plus years B.C., and we have the law, children been given all the law, the Ten Commandments, and now he's going to give them this thing called a tabernacle. And let's read, and this is a very important thing for the children of Israel. God specifically gave them this, and we'll find out here in a minute, or in a little bit, as we see this. This style of tabernacle was built so that the children of Israel could move. And so wherever they would move, they would set this up. It was not a permanent building like we have today, church building, or even the temple that David built that we'll get to later on. This was one that they could take down. It was built with specific instructions, and they were able to move it wherever they went. Okay? Because remember, Mount Sinai is the mountain that God came down, and it's where he would dwell. But the children of Israel weren't going to live on the mountain, right? So if God's presence was to be able to go with them, he was going to have something in place that he could go rest at, right? When he came down to visit them. So let's read here and see what happens.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and they bring me an offering. From everyone who gives it, it will move with its heart, and you shall take my offering. And this is the offering which you shall take from them: gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, fine linen and goat's hair, ram skins, dyed red badger skins, and acacia wood. All for the light and spices for the anointing oil and for the sweet incense, onyx stones and stones to be set in the ephod and in the breastplate. And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them."
Okay, so God gives them his instructions. What did God promise to the children of Israel if they were to do what he said? Not in these verses here, but prior to this.
He would be with them.
He would be with them, and he would bless them, right? And what would happen if they did not do that? Well, what's the opposite of blessing or giving? Being blessed. Not blessed, right? Yeah, God's going to pull away from them. He said, "I will move away from you. I will not be with you. I will withdraw myself."
Covenant.
Mm-hmm. Yes, his covenant was that if you honor me to the children of Israel and follow what I tell you to do, I will be with you and I will bless you. If you don't do this, then you're going to be cursed and you are going to be punished with death by those around you. Okay? That's what would happen. If he did not, they would not bless the nation and they would die. Kind of reminds you what God said to Adam and Eve. You obey, and you'll be successful. You'll be blessed. You know, these are the things that you won't have to worry about. You have all this fun. But if you do this, you will die. Same thing, kind of, right? What does that tell us about God? He keeps his word and he does what? Huh?
Keeps
his promise and he doesn't change.
So he's making this list here, and these are the same people that have been wandering in the desert for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Gold and silver and seal skins and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. And they would have got a lot of that from where?
Egypt.
When they left Egypt, they were given. Remember, they pillaged and took all that stuff.
True.
So they've been carrying around all this stuff for.
That's true.
With them. Now, I don't know about you, but you know, you see movies and things where someone gets, you're out in the desert and you're walking along the highway, you got a big backpack on and you're hot and you start shedding things, right, along the way. I would imagine some of that took place, but we still have a record that they have a lot of stuff here, a lot of wealth.
The seal skins is what gets me, because that's pretty far away, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the Red Sea, where they crossed, was. Where, I don't know what's in that. I mean, at that time, there might have been seals there. I don't know. And if there were a type of seals, they might have went a little seal hunting. I don't know. Where they would have got this from. But you have that. So, God knew the Israelites were not going to keep everything that he told them, right? Because God knows everything. He knew they would fail, correct?
Right.
And if God knows they were going to fail, and he gives them these laws, what made God know the Israelites would fail? Why would he know that? Because nobody's perfect, right? They were sinners, they were born sinners, and they're always going to be sinners, right? Same way we are. We're born sinners, and we're always going to have some element of wrong in us, even though we may have chosen to follow the deliverer, and he's forgiven us of those sins. We're still going to make mistakes. Nobody's here perfect, right? Not one of us could answer that we've kept the Ten Commandments last week, right? Every single one of them, we were perfect. We were broken all, in the sense of how we talked about how the deliverer gave us a new set of standards with the Ten Commandments, correct? So thinking along that lines, the Israelites had already failed, right? Here, they knew they were going to do this. So while they were on this mountain, while Moses was on this mountain, what were the children of Israel doing? Moses was given the Ten Commandments. What were the children of Israel doing? We're not going to really talk about that here, but what were they doing? They were making an idol. They were already breaking one of God's commandments. And when God gave them the Ten Commandments and the law, he said, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," right? And that was one of them. Here he's up on the mountain, getting the Ten Commandments from God for 40 days. And while he's up there, they're building this idol.
Right.
They're in party mode. And we know that while they're up there, Joshua hears a noise and he tells Moses, "Hey, it sounds like a sound of war in the camp." And he goes back down. Maybe I'm quoting the movie. I have to go back and read the actual story all the way through, word for word, make sure I'm not wrong with that. But and they come off the mountain, and here they are worshiping this idol. Doing wicked things. So God had set this tabernacle up, and he gives them specific instructions here of what needs to be brought to them, all the things that, and he tells them it's a list of offerings. It's an offering to God. He wants them to bring this stuff as an offering to him. And he's building a place where the sins of the Israelites could be forgiven. So when you think about that, why would God set up a place or provide a place for where the children of Israel could have their sins forgiven? Why do you think God would want to do that?
What, to go off on their own?
No, I mean, why would God want to have a place set up? The tabernacle was a place set up so that the children of Israel could have their sins forgiven. Why would he set that up? Want to be close to him?
Well, he still doesn't want anybody to perish.
Right. So. This goes back to the character and the heart of God, that he wants to have that relationship, that bridge or that gap in that picture restored. And so the deliverer hasn't come yet, And so God is making a way for the children of Israel to have that relationship restored.
Like that phone booth or something.
Similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in between there. It can't be completely restored because the deliverer isn't here yet. But he's providing a way for them to have their sins forgiven until the deliverer comes. So he's merciful, he's gracious. God certainly didn't want to kill any more people. Right? God doesn't, that's not God's heart. That's not God's heart. So let's read what verse 9 says.
According to all that I show thee, the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all the furniture thereof, even so shall ye make it. And they shall make an ark of Arcadia wood. 2 cubits and a half shall be the length thereof, and 1.5 cubits the breadth thereof, and 1.5 cubits the height thereof. And thou shalt overlay it with pure gold within and without. Shalt thou overlay it, and shalt make it upon the crown of gold round about.
Okay. So he gives them specific instructions on what to do right off the bat here. He tells them that, okay, this tabernacle must be built exactly as I show you or tell you how it needs to be built. I'm going to give you a pattern, and I want you to follow this instruction. It's kind of like a blueprint. You build a house, you follow it. Now, what happens when you get a blueprint?
You veer away from it sometimes, right?
We get, you get the house up, and you got the blueprint, you see it on paper, and it looks great, and then, if I remember right, when we built this church, we added on here, this wall was originally back here. In between here and here, on the blueprints. We're supposed to be right in here by that. And so when we got this building built, we're like, oh, this is where the wall's going to look like. Man, we ain't going to have very much of a lobby. Blueprints call for it to be back here. You know what? You can check with the inspector. If they don't have a problem with it, we're going to move it up to here. Now, I'm kind of glad we did because we're meeting in this lobby. But if this was God's blueprint, and he said you don't veer from it, then we couldn't move the wall where we wanted to. It had to be right here.
Right.
And that's what God's telling them. I'm going to give you a blueprint, and I want everything followed out. Where else in the Bible that we've learned so far?
The ark.
The ark, right? Who else? Where else? With specific instructions given. Yes, exactly. How much food to prepare for the Passover, how it was to be prepared, what to do on the lintel with the blood and making sure that. How about Cain and Abel? Cain's sacrifice was rejected because he didn't
follow the
right. Exactly. Adam and Eve, God gave specific instructions. Don't eat of the tree. It started with that. And here's, so again, we see the heart of God, we see the character of God, that God is consistent in everything he does. He's not changing everything. When he says he wants something done a certain way, it gets done a certain way. If we don't, he withdrew his blessing from the children. So here he is laying this out.
So this is a dumb question, but where are they getting all this gold from?
Yeah.
There's 2 million people there.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, well, we don't know how many it is now, but estimated 2.5 million came out of Egypt. You got 40 years, you're going to have some that died off and then some that were born. So there would have been a lot of wealth.
My question is why gold? Why not something else? A little more, you know,
well, isn't gold
available
in
the area, you know what I mean?
Could have been other stuff.
Yeah.
Well, gold's a sign of wealth. I mean, even today, what are these infomercials on TV or you hear it on the radio? Buy gold, and you know when the oil prices go down, gold is always what stands. And you know, I saw someone on Facebook had posted a little thing where this guy was standing on the street corner next to a pawn shop or a jewelry where they would buy silver and gold. And he had I forget how many ounces. It was just a bar of silver. And he offered it to everybody that walked by. I mean, he was standing there with a bar of silver in his hand. And he said, how much would you give me for this bar of silver? How about $200? People said, no, I'd give you $200 for it. He went all the way down to $25, and not one person would give him $25 for this bar of silver. He took that bar of silver and went into the pawn shop, or the jewelry place that bought the silver. He got $1,500 for this bar of silver. He was basically trying to show people that, hey, this is what that bar of silver is worth. Give me $200 for them. They wouldn't even give them $200 if they would have known what the value of that silver was. Now, not a lot of us study silver. We're dealing with dollar bills and $20 bills and paper money today. But there has to be a certain level of gold or in the treasury to back up that dollar. Correct?
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Maybe not anymore. They just print it.
To be honest, I'm not going to trust just some man standing on the corner.
I would agree with you. I don't even think I would have done that. I don't think I would have done that either. The example, though, is that the children of Israel, and we will see when David builds the temple, when he builds the temple, they overlay things in gold. When we get to heaven, the streets are going to be paved with pure gold. Now, anybody ever see real gold, pure gold? Yeah, what's it like?
I have some.
You have some pure gold?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, how many times does it take to get pure gold? 24 karat gold.
24 karat gold?
Yeah.
How many times it has to be smelted?
Yeah.
Processed.
I'm
not exactly sure.
It's a lot, right? It's not just one time. I'm wearing a gold
ring. They have to get rid of the impurities. Every time they smelt it, they skim it.
Yep.
Melt it again and skim it.
And pure gold is not, this isn't pure gold, so I don't know if this is, I don't even know what it is. I don't know, maybe it's 14 karat gold.
It's a metal that's easily manipulated.
Exactly, yeah. And so, in order to get pure gold, you refine it, and you refine it over and over, take all the old stuff off, refine it again and again. And it's a process that goes through there. Why there was so much gold? I can only go back to what took place when they left Egypt. That they says they, and Egypt was the nation of wealth.
It was the Mecca.
Remember Joseph before, everybody from around came and brought money to make it through the famine. So they became a very wealthy, wealthy nation. And the Israelites were commanded, go to your neighbor and pillage that. Basically take from their neighbor. And they gave them because they wanted to get rid of them. So I can imagine that a lot of those children of Israel left there with a lot of wealth. And
heavy
they carried
stuff.
Yeah. Heavy stuff to carry around. I mean, to be moving and all that. And maybe they found gold deposits along the way. I don't know. In Babylon, in Iraq, right? So Iraq or Iran, they are rebuilding the Babylonian city. I think you can Google it. It is called the City of Gold, or the Golden City. They're making this a city out of gold. But it's over in that Babylonian area. Be kind of cool. Maybe we can see if we can find that posted on Facebook, see if we can pull some of those pictures up. Well, anyways, they're going to travel great distances and over things. So this tabernacle had to be transportable, okay? And so whenever God told the children of Israel to pitch their tent, this tabernacle was to be set in the center of the camp. So they would set their camp up, and all the surrounding tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel, would surround this tabernacle. So this would be right in the center. And the tabernacle was only going to have two rooms in it. And let's see if I can get a picture here. There you go. So this is what the kind of the layout or description of somebody drew up based on the description that's in the Bible here. And if you go to Lancaster area, Pennsylvania, Hershey, Pennsylvania, there is a tabernacle that is built there to give a picture of the history. As a kid, I remember going and visiting this. It's been years.
It'd probably be a very bright room.
Yeah. It's close up there to Lancaster, somewhere in that area. My parents, for a school trip, took us. And maybe it's not there anymore, but this was a long time ago. But you can kind of see here on this tabernacle. So you have, here's the Ark of the Covenant. Then you have right here on the outside of it is the, with the mercy seat, is they got the curtain of the veil. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into that a little bit. I don't know if we'll get into it tonight, but this veil is in place. Here's your high priest is on the outside. And when the high priest would go into this area to meet with God, he had to make sure that he didn't have anything wrong. In other words, he had to be his sins. He had to offer the sacrifices. And when he went in to meet with God to offer the sacrifices onto the mercy seat, the altar, they would tie a rope around his leg. Because if he went in there and he wasn't right with God, God would kill him. Mm-hmm. Okay? And there, nobody could go in there to get him. Well, he had to get the dead body out, or, you know, what happens when the dead body's laying around. Right? So you had to get the dead body out. So they would pull the priest out if that took place. And so specific things. God gave specific instructions for these things. Of course, you got some of this stuff here. So let's so as you're thinking about that, and this all had to be able to be taken down. It was a very specific thing that took place. The first room was considered what we call the holy place. This room was considered the most holy place. Okay, so even the outer area was considered holy. We had the chest back there, or what they called the Ark of the Covenant, and that was to be made for a specific purpose too. We read verse 10 and 11, and it gives a description. 45 inches long, 27 inches wide, 27 inches high. Overlay it inside and out with pure gold, running a molding all the way around it. It said to cast four rings and attach them to its 4 feet, 2 rings on each side. Make poles from a specific wood, archaea wood, acacia wood, I don't know. Overlay them with gold, insert the poles into the rings on the side to carry the ark. These poles and rings must stay inside the rings. Never remove them. When the ark is finished, place it inside the stone tablets, which were what? God's law. The Ten Commandments, the law, God's law to the children of Israel, were to go inside of that. And the terms of the covenant that God had made with the children of Israel and the children of Israel with him.
So did God actually write the tablets, or did Moses do?
Well, God wrote the tablets. Moses wrote the tablets, and then he broke them, right? And then God wrote them. It's the other way around. One set Moses wrote, and one set God wrote. The set that, I have to go back and check on that. I'm not sure which set. Moses broke a set.
Oh, yeah.
When he got angry, when he came down and he saw they were, and he had to go back up on the mountain and get the next set. God. And I can't remember which set he broke. Did he break the set that God first wrote? I think it's the set that he wrote, that Moses keyed as God gave him the Ten Commandments. He wrote these down on the tablet. And then I think that's the set he broke. And then
the ones that God wrote were put into the ark.
The ark. Mm-hmm. I'd have to double check that. If someone can find that where the first set was broken, we can see which set was the one that God. This very specific thing. He even gives instruction how the cherubims, or the angels that we talked about, were to be positioned over top of them. And you can continue to read down through there how they were to be set up. And then he goes on to verses 17 through 20. It says this. Make the ark cover, place the atonement from pure gold. It must be, again, give the instructions there. Then make 2 cherubims from hammered gold and place them on the 2 ends of the atonement cover, the top part. Mold the cherubims on each side of the atonement cover, making it all one piece of gold. The cherubim will face each other and look down on the atonement cover with wings spread above it, that they will protect it place inside the ark the stone tablets inscribed with the terms of the covenants, which I will give you. Then put the atonement cover on the top of the ark. I will meet with you there and talk to you from the atonement cover between the golden cherubim and hover over the ark of the covenant. From there I will give you my commands for the people of Israel. So God is going to stand over top of this. Just to make sure, everybody knows what the cherubim is, right?
Angels.
Yeah. Right. There, it's an angel.
The ones that flew above God.
Mm-hmm. With the wing, it had the description of wings, and if you go into Revelation, there's some other description of cherubims. But yeah, mm-hmm. They have wings. And
version here calls it a mercy seat.
Mm-hmm. Yep, this is the mercy seat. Yep, and we'll get to that. What position were the angels supposed to be facing in these verses? Outward?
Inward
and face down, looking, protecting the covenant that God had established with the children of Israel. In the scriptures, the cherubim represent, or the presence of a cherubim represents God's holiness and his righteousness. The way it talks about a lot of times with cherubim. So in this particular thing, they are there. It's a representation. Can you imagine? Picture this. They would have so many men carrying this. When they went, and they went out in front. So when they crossed the Jordan River, the Ark of the Covenant went first, and as soon as the high priests that were carrying the Ark of the Covenant's feet touched the Jordan River, the river split apart, and they were able to pass across. We'll get to that story when we get to that. But the Ark of the Covenant was a very, very important piece. Instruction from God. It had to be built specifically. It was a specific purpose.
Now, can the angels see God?
Can angels see God?
Or does he hide his face from everyone?
That's a good question.
I thought there was a passage in there about the angels couldn't look upon the face of God.
That's a very good question. Let me write that one down, because I think there's some scripture verses that talk about that. Can angels see God? We'll look that up. We'll see if we can find some of that and find that answer. That's a very good question. Where else did we hear about cherubims, though, in the Bible prior to this?
In the beginning.
In the beginning. What were they doing?
Guarding the garden.
Yes, God put them in flaming swords, and those swords turned whichever way. They were there guarding the garden. And God had done that. They had set up, they were guarding, so they were keeping them from the tree of life.
Yeah, the cherubim and the seraphim.
Mm-hmm. The Lord told Moses to place the two tablets of stone in the ark. On those tablets, he had written them there. And then his presence was going to come down and hover over that area. And the children of Israel called this, when God's glory came down into this holy of holies, the most holy place inside, the inner room, they called this the Shekinah glory. That's what the children of Israel called it, Shekinah glory. That curtain that's right there would divide that room, the inner room, from the outer room. And let's get a picture of what that curtain looked like. And the curtain is very important. This curtain is a very important part of the tabernacle and in the life of the deliverer that is to come. And when we get further on towards the end of our class, we will hear again about this curtain. 26, someone read 26, Exodus 26, 31 and 33, and let's see what this curtain was like.
You shall make a veil woven of blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen. It shall be woven with an artistic design of cherubim. You shall hang it upon the four pillars of acacia wood overlaid with gold. Their hooks shall be gold upon four sockets of silver. And you shall hang the veil from the clasp. Then you shall bring the ark of the testimony in there, behind the veil. The veil shall be divided from you between the holy place and the most holy.
Why do you think God put this veil there? Okay, but why couldn't anybody see God's presence? Or why couldn't just anybody see God?
Could be death.
Could be death. I'm looking for the reason why they weren't allowed. Why aren't we allowed to see God?
Because
right, because of we're imperfect, we are sin. This piece was to keep out separation, sin from God. In other words, God is holy. God is just. He's perfect. He can't be in that presence of sin. When the high priest was to go, before he would go in there, he would have specific instructions as to what he was to do for himself so that he would be covered, so that when he went into God's presence, he wouldn't die. There were some specific things that he had to do. So it was pretty serious business to enter into God's presence. Mm-hmm. And God set this up as a dividing curtain to make sure that we were separate so that he would not go on and kill people. Okay? So he set that up. And from the description of it here, this was a very pretty curtain. It was beautiful. I mean, describes it as purple and finely woven linen, you know, and gold. It was skillfully embroidered. Think about the people that sewed this. Knowing the importance, I mean, knowing, hey, I don't know how many people sewed that. Maybe it was 100 people put it together. I don't know. But here they are thinking, okay, this is, I am having a cool, to me, it'd be really cool. It would have been really cool to be part of. Let me be the artist to make the rings of gold, you know, to beat them out and find and make it smooth, part of God's tabernacle. I mean, just the honor that would have been to be a part of something like that. And he was doing it because he loved the people. He loved the children of Israel and he loved people, and he didn't want to have to go in and destroy them. Because they rushed it. I remember he set the boundary up around the mountain. That way they couldn't rush the mountain. But it was also a reminder, constant reminder, that, hey, we're sinners. God is holy. We cannot enter into that.
So if God was big enough to be up on top of a whole mountain, how does his size change? How does he get small enough?
Well, he's God, man. Come on. So, yeah, you have, scroll through here.
Remember, God can be in more than one place at the same time.
God is on.
He can be everywhere.
Yes.
What is a bema seat and a mercy seat? What's the difference?
Say that again?
So, the bema seat.
The bemeth?
Bema
seat. Where did you see that? Did we read that?
The mercy seat.
Is that what you're referring to? What's the difference between that and what you call the bema seat?
Yeah.
Again, I've never heard of the bema seat. I'll have to look that one up.
Is that like maybe his throne or something?
Could be. I'll have to look it up. I've never heard of that one. Yeah. And it could be a different word. Maybe that's a Hebrew word for mercy seat. I don't know. It could be too. That's a very good question. I wrote it down. So we have this on the outside. And here you have the courtyard. So you can kind of see how they would enter in. Here it is, the tabernacle. And then you were to... And again, this is, again, somebody's picture drawing that they come up with, maybe through history or studying and how it was laid out. We do know that they had an outer courtyard, and it was laid out with posts like this around it. And they would offer sacrifices out here. This was built a specific size. The bowl here for washing was built a certain size, certain way, certain things with that. And that all those things were in place.
This was just a temporary structure.
Correct. This was not a permanent structure. They would take this down each and every time they picked up and moved on to the next campsite.
Right.
And they would set this all up. And this was in the center of their campsite, or the children of Israel. This was in the middle.
So they knock on the door and say, "God, we're moving now. We got to take down the house."
God would tell them to move.
Yes. God would tell them when to move, and okay. they would pack up and okay, we're moving, and off they would go. Exodus 27. Here, this maybe give a little bit more about the outer point to that. 27 verse 9 says this. Then make the courtyard of the tabernacle enclosed with curtains made of finely woven linen. On the south side, make the curtain 150 feet long. They will be held up with 20 posts and set securely in 20 bronze bases, hanging the curtains with silver hooks and rings. Make the curtains the same on the north side, 150 feet of curtains held up again, and so on and forth. The curtains on the west side of the courtyard are 75 feet. So it's 75 feet, 150 feet. That's how he had them set up. He had specific instructions on how this was all to be done. There was to be a brazen altar set up in the courtyard in the center. When God built Noah's Ark, or God told Noah to build the ark, what did he get? What was one of the specific instructions that he set up with that?
What, like the length, width?
He had all that, and then he gave a specific instruction, make one door. He only had one door, right?
Right.
And that's it. One window. One door, one window. There was to be a single opening in this courtyard. Only one. Not one over here, not one back there. One opening.
One entrance.
One entrance. Well, I think it goes to more than that. It could be that, hey, that you wanted to have it so that everybody that entered had to enter through one area. He was able to control. But I think it goes to a more important issue that, or a more important point, that God only has one way that man can be restored with him. It doesn't mean that I can come this direction to God or I can come this direction to God. No, it's only one way. And we see that with Noah. He only had one way into the ark. God was the one who closed the door of the ark. He didn't let Noah close the door, so he said, "I will close the door when I'm good and ready and ready to close the door." He told him to get on, but God closed it. There was only one opening, though. Same way with this, only one opening. Just like everybody who was saved from God's judgment with Noah on the ark, through that one opening, everybody here could have their sins forgiven through one opening. We're going to skip all the way now, all the way over to Leviticus chapter 1, which I don't know, that's a few more chapters ahead. And God gives some specific instructions here for this altar out here in the courtyard. The Lord called Moses from the tabernacle and said to him, "Give the following instructions to the people of Israel. When you present an animal as an offering to the Lord, you may take it from your herd of cattle or your flock of sheep and goats. If the animal you present as a burnt offering is from the herd, it must be a male with no defects." Where else do we remember that? Anybody remember where that took place?
The ram.
Abraham, when he went to offer Isaac as a sacrifice, the ram, correct. Yeah, so he had that. Bring it to the entrance of the tabernacle so you may be accepted by the Lord. Lay your hand on the animal's head, and the Lord will accept its death in your place to purify you, making you right with him. Then slaughter the young bull in the Lord's presence, and Aaron's sons, the priests, will present the animal's blood by splattering it against the sides of the altar that stands at the entrance to the tabernacle. Specific instructions for a man to be accepted to God. Now, I don't know. This is a golden altar. I would wonder when you have 2.5 million people, or maybe more, maybe less, but in there, and they've now committed sins, and they've got to come before God to correct their sins, to make their sins right before God, and follow these specific instructions. I wonder if that gold was really gold looking on that altar after a tremendous amount of sacrifices were done. Because it says they splattered the gold with the blood of the animal on the outside of that altar. They threw it on the outside of the altar. With specific things. The animal's blood was not paying for their sin. If you notice what it said in there, someone else want to read it. Maybe it's a little different wording there. What does it say that the animal's blood go to verse 4. Someone read verse 4.
Shall present the blood and sprinkle the blood round about upon the altar that is after the Lord of the temple.
On verse 4?
Oh, that's 5. So, and he shall lay his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him.
Atonement. That's the word I was looking for. Mine doesn't say atonement here. What's atonement?
To make up for their sins.
It's
like repentance.
It's what?
Repentance. It
was the act. An atonement is a covering. So what God was saying, when these children of Israel were to do this, they were being, their sin would be atoned for, covered. It could not be made right. The animal's blood did not save them, did not make them right. The animal's blood did not give them, just as when God created and killed the first sacrifice, where he took the clothing and made clothing for Adam and Eve. He was a covering to cover.
So the animal's life was a covering for man's.
Correct.
Because the penalty for sin is death.
Exactly. Yes. So the sin that man committed, they were supposed to die. So God provided a way for man to have a covering of their sin, because the liver is not here yet. So he provided a way through the shedding of blood, which is very important, for the payment of sin. Because that's the only way that our sin can be paid for, is death. It's what we deserve. And so God provided this covering. Just as he covered Adam and Eve, through that, he's now providing a way for the children of Israel to have a covering for their sins. Okay?
How often do they have to do that?
It tells us that in here. I don't think it's in this chapter here as how often. I think it's once a year. They had to go up before the high priest and offer a sacrifice for their sins. It was a specific time of the year. They had a burnt offering for their sin.
And that's for everybody.
Everybody. Yes. So can you imagine how many animals were slaughtered?
Wow. Well, I mean, you got to imagine how many perfect animals.
That's right.
There were.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Can you imagine? You are a shepherd. And you've got, or even maybe not a shepherd, maybe you're a carpenter. Or you're a farmer. You grow crops. Mm-hmm. And, or you are, you have some livestock. And here comes this lamb, or this cow, and it's born and it's perfect. And you know that that's the one that you're going to have to take every year up to the tabernacle to pay for your covering of your sins. You're going to take care of that animal, aren't you?
Right.
I mean, either that or you don't really care about what God says.
Right.
But you're going to take care of that. Make sure nothing happens to that animal. Everything's got to be perfect on this animal. Without blemish, it says.
But on the flip side, that is, as a farmer, you want to weed out your weak animals and keep your strong. And it must have been something for them to give up the best of their flock.
Absolutely.
You want to keep your best.
You want to keep them, right? Yeah. Yeah, you guys wouldn't want to give up any of your good chickens, right? Go out and just start killing off good chickens. You want to get rid of the ones that aren't going to produce any weight.
Chickens, I really care about
thinking
about cows.
Cows, too, right? You don't want to give up your best cow, right? You want money for it if you do, right? You want top dollar. Yeah, and God is saying that. It was costing them something. It was going to cost them something.
Well, I know in the Jewish religion today, they still look for the perfect animal. I hear and read about smatterings about that.
Mm-hmm.
Or you see something in the news.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's amazing to me how many they don't offer sacrifices in Israel as in like they do here. That's not being done anymore. Although there is talk about that before God returns to take his church home, that they are going to go back to that route.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple who used to be here. She was from a Jewish family and had family over there. And she went over one time to visit them, and they have everything set up. All this stuff is built and ready to go for the temple, to rebuild the temple. Not like the outer court, but the Holy of Holies. They have all that stuff set up again. And who knows when they'll go back to that. But she was surprised by that when she went over there. Exodus 28 verse 1 says this. We're kind of jumping back. Someone grab Exodus 16, or Leviticus 16, because that's where we're going to go next. But Exodus 28 verse 1 says this. Call your brother Aaron and his sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. Set them apart from the rest of the people of Israel, so they may minister to me and be my priests. God set these priests, specific men, aside for doing the work of the tabernacle. Couldn't just be anybody. They had to be specific men set aside for that. This is your answer, John, with regard to the specific time. Leviticus 16, 2 through 3. Someone got that.
The Lord said to Moses, tell your brother Aaron that he will not come whenever he wants into the holy place behind the veil in front of the mercy seat and the ark, or else he will die. Because I will appear in the fowl of the mercy seat. Aaron is to enter the most holy place in this way, with a young bull for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. He is to wear the holy linen tunic and linen undergarments, or to be on his body. He must tie a linen sash around him and wrap his head with a linen turban. These are holy garments. He must bathe his body with water before he wears them. He is to take from the Israelite community two male goats for a sin offering.
This is called the Day of Atonement. This is when he would go in and offer the sacrifice. And if you continue to read on through this list here, you will see what Aaron would have to do on this day for the atoning of the children of Israel's sins. It's amazing. He has to wash a certain way. He has to do specific things. There was just wasn't, okay, I'm going to go off of this and walk right in. No, there were specific instructions in order to enter into the presence of God.
I wonder if they practiced it with no perfume.
to make sure you get it right?
Yeah.
I think I would. Yeah. I mean, these are specific instructions here. You have to remember, oh, did I miss a step? Oh, wait a minute. Yes, I got to go back. Wait a minute.
They talk about his purchase and his girl and everything else. He's got a grounding. Wow.
Yep. And then if you go to the next verse, which is verse 15 we want to read, what's verse 15 say he has to do?
When he slaughters the male goat for the people's sin offering and brings its blood inside the veil, he must do the same with its blood as he did with the bull's blood. He has to sprinkle it against the mercy seat in front of it.
So specific, again, instructions on what he does with the blood. Now, did he have a cup and splatter it? Did he take his fingers and do this? He has specific instructions to splatter the blood on the mercy seat. You continue to go on. Aaron will come out to purify the altar that stands before the Lord. Verse 18. He must sprinkle the blood with his finger 7 times over the altar in this way. He will cleanse it from Israel's defilement and make it holy. So after he's done, he's got this other thing to do. No one may enter until he comes out again to purify himself and his family before the congregation of Israel, making them right with God, the covering, the atonement. I don't like that word. I don't like the way this translation uses that, because it is an atonement. It's not making them right with God. It's covering their sins. This translation is using it here and saying, I am right with God. No man is right with God until the deliverer comes. So up to that point, they have an atonement, a covering of their sins. When you think about this thing here, he would sprinkle the blood on the mercy seat. Why again could not the blood of the animals pay for their sin? Animals' blood can't pay for our sin, right? No, it's the shedding of blood, our blood. God demands death. That's the only way. That's what you shall die. That's why it's a covering. It's called atonement. And atonement means basically a covering. So make sure, don't forget that. Because when we get into the New Testament and we start talking about the deliverer, that covering, it comes alive. It'll be a little more real to you.
Because through the deliverer, sins are forgiven. If you're saying through all of this, they're not really forgiven, they're just covered up.
It's just covered up. Yeah. They're not. Their sin was not paid for until the deliverer came. They couldn't be paid for. But God had to make a way because the deliverer wasn't there yet. So, what does that tell you about God?
I'm not understanding. Why did we have to make the way for their sins to be covered if they're really not forgiven until later?
Well, what would happen to them if God didn't do that?
Just die.
Right. So when they died, where would they go?
Well, they died before the deliverer came.
Right.
So what, are forgiven until after he's here, right? I mean, you're saying this only covers them.
Correct. That's correct. So I'm not sure. Maybe I could go off. Maybe I could come back to it after I turn this off.
This is just to be in the presence of God.
If he didn't do this for them now, they would die. But they're going to die anyway.
If they died without the covering or having the blood, an atonement made for their sins, they would have died in that. Remember the three deaths?
Yes.
So they would have died eternal death, which is forever separated from God.
So even though they died in the body, this covered them until.
Yes. Yes. And it's hard for me to grasp that because, like you said, why would God need to do that? He knew the deliverer was going to cover them, but then that means that everybody would have been covered. And only people that were covered were those who offered the sacrifices for atonement and followed the instructions. I'm not sure. I would venture to say in our world today, Not everybody accepts the deliverer and follows him. So in this sense, I don't know that everybody in this camp followed him and went on the Day of Atonement. And they may have said, hey, in matter of fact, there is a story through here called the Sons of Korah, where they rebelled against God, and God got angry at them and caused the ground to open up and swallow them. And those were people who rebelled against God and said, we're not going to follow what you're saying to do. And so God said, okay, well, I'm removing you from my people. You can't, you know, and swallow. Exactly. So there were probably children of Israel, or people in the children of Israel, or they would have left, that said, I'm not doing this. And so they would have died an eternal death, forever separated from God. The character of God is shown very strongly through this whole aspect of the tabernacle, because he doesn't want man to be separated from him. So he's providing a way, knowing that, hey, when the deliverer comes and he pays the price for the man's sins, they no longer have to do it. And that's where that veil. In the New Testament, when the deliverer comes and he pays the price for their sins, that veil is split top to bottom. It's rented apart, and there's no longer a need for the mercy seat anymore. And from that point on, we don't hear any sacrifice or anything listed in the Bible. And so that's why this is a very important part of the children of Israel's passage in life, but it is. I mean, it's part of their, if they don't do this, they are saying that they don't.
I can just imagine that many sacrifices, the kind of stench and the smell and the decay of the bodies and all that stuff would be just a mess.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot of animals were slaughtered.
Yes.
That each year they would go through that.
So, let's see if I can phrase this. Out of all those, what do you say, 2 million people?
That's what they estimate. We don't know that, but yeah.
This would be like a license for some people. They do whatever they want, because we know that not every single person had to follow this, the law. Not everybody was following it to the T. So how many people were just doing whatever they want and then they just give the sacrifice? What kept somebody from doing that? In other words, like, did people do that, or was there,
So you're asking the question that, okay, so they know they got the Day of Atonement, so for, and that's, let's say, 365 days, so
right.
on day 365 they go and have an atonement, and 364 days of the year they're doing whatever they want and living in sin, just living crazy. There is a problem with that, because when God specific, that means they could go kill somebody, they could do whatever they want. God had specific consequences for those laws. And so they could just do whatever they want. Matter of fact, take some time and read through Exodus and Leviticus and read exactly what God puts in there. God has consequences in there for sexual sins. He's got consequences in there for if you kill somebody. He's specific things. If you even injure somebody in a fight. So suppose two men were struggling and fighting, and one of the wives of the men were there and they were pregnant. And you swing and miss your opponent and punch the pregnant woman in the stomach, and you injure or kill the baby inside, there was consequences for that. God had specific things laid out, consequence-wise, for the children of Israel. So it wasn't like they were just living lawlessly up until the Day of Atonement. Matter of fact, I think they probably would have, for the most part, been pretty moral people by law or by standards because of all the laws they had. And yet that still didn't make them perfect. They still had to offer that sacrifice. So could be, though, that there were people that were doing that.
It seems like with all the laws, you get legalistic and it would be this thing you follow, and you would lose your love or your heart. Now, how much of that, if their heart's not right, but they're still following that, are they still covered? Or if their heart's right, but they, you know...
That's That's a very good question, because think about that on today's scale. So today, we have the mercy and grace, right? We've seen the two flyers with mercy and grace. There are certain today where Christians say, well, I'm under grace, so I can just do whatever I want. God's going to forgive me. He's got this covering, you know. I'm covered under grace. I'm good and I'm in. It's not that way. God's grace does cover our sin, but God sees the heart of man, exactly like what you're saying. And so God knew these people's hearts. So there probably was people whose heart, whether or not they were covered, that I can't tell you, because I don't know what God's going to do with somebody who has a heart that says, I'll just get away with what I can get away with, and I'll just follow, be legalistic and just follow the law, follow that. God knows the heart. That's what he's about. He's about the heart. A very good question. I'm glad I'm not the judge. I'm glad he's got to make that decision, not me. Let's finish up here with Exodus 39, 42 through 43, and then Exodus 40, verse 17. And this is what happens when God comes into children of Israel's presence, or the presence of in the midst of the camp. Exodus 39:42-43 says this: So the people of Israel followed all the Lord's instructions to Moses. Then Moses inspected all their work. When he had found it had been done just as the Lord had commanded him, he blessed them. And then you skip down to verse 17 of chapter 40. So the tabernacle was set up on the first day of the first month of the second year. And then 40, verse 34 says this. Then the cloud, let's read 34 through the end of the chapter. Then the cloud covered the tabernacle, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could no longer enter the tabernacle because the cloud had settled down over it. It settled down over it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Now, whenever the cloud lifted from the tabernacle, the people of Israel would set out on their journey following it. But if the cloud did not rise, they remained where they were until it lifted. The cloud of the Lord hovered over the tabernacle during the day, and at night a fire glowed inside the cloud so the whole family of Israel could see it. This continued throughout all their journeys. Now, we do not know. Let me say this. I've got to be very careful about this. I do not know where it's found in the Bible where the Shekinah glory of the Lord left. In other words, remember the cloud that comes down, that is God's presence. They called it his Shekinah glory. We do not know when the last time that Shekinah glory came down and left. This is not recorded. Before I turn this off, any comments on this? Because I want to go a little bit further with this after the thing's turned off here. Okay, well, I'm going to turn it off. Just because I want to go, I want to take this a little bit further. Because it